From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, emotional testimony from police officers who defended the Capitol on January 6th.
One man tried and failed to build a rapport with me, shouting, "Are you my brother?" Another takes a different tack, shouting, "You will die on your knees."
Simone Biles steps away from competition, citing mental health concerns.
If gymnasts doesn't have his or her mind in that right place, they can injure themselves, they can break their necks, they can even kill themselves.
And we're going back to 1969, not for Woodstock, for the Harlem Cultural Festival.
I'm looking at over 40 hours of footage of really some amazing performances, and I'm just trying to rack my brain out to think, who would deny this?
All ahead on Perspective. This week, we heard searing testimony from the Capitol Hill police officers who held back rioters on January 6th. And we watched as one of America's top Olympians pulled away from what was arguably the biggest competition of her career. We'll get to those stories. But we're going to begin with the spread of the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Almost everyone hospitalized due to COVID now is unvaccinated. And this week, we got new guidance on masks. CDC Director Rochelle Walensky.
In areas with substantial and high transmission, CDC recommends fully vaccinated people wear masks in public indoor settings.
And when it comes to schools,
CDC recommends that everyone in K-12 schools wear a mask indoors, including teachers, staff, students, and visitors, regardless of vaccination status.
New research came out this week revealing just how much not being in the classroom has affected the nation's students. ABC's Alex Stone has been taking a look.
This new research, Sherry, coming amid the drumbeat now from political and health leaders saying kids have to go back full time to classes this school year. But many parents are getting worried based on where COVID numbers are going that a county or a state might say, well, kids are unvaccinated and they have to go remote again. I know a lot of our friends in the LA Unified School District, they're worried that LA could go that way. No indication that they will. But generally, you're hearing this coming from the CDC in recent days.
The children can and should be back to full-time in-person learning in the fall.
Well, now this new report by NWEA, a Portland-based academic research firm, saying elementary and middle school students had lower rates of achievement gains last year. Yes, they did learn last year, but not at the rate that they would in a normal year. I was able to get on Zoom with Dr. Karen Lewis, who's the lead researcher.
We're just seeing diminished learning rates compared to a normal year. We first checked in the fall when kids returned to the classroom after the shutdowns of spring of 2020. And when we looked at what was happening at that point, we saw some bright spots. Reading seemed to be holding steady, but we saw declines in math. This latest round of research checks in after a full year of learning during the pandemic. And what we're seeing is that reading is no longer a bright spot, especially for our youngest learners.
Now, they looked at 5.5 million math and reading scores. They saw declines, especially in math and especially in high poverty areas. Most interesting to many is that the gains in math and reading really took a dip going into the spring. And the thinking is the kids and teachers were just burned out by then. They had nothing left.
Once winter hit, that's when pandemic fatigue really hit hard. And kids certainly were not immune from just being over it, being denied their social connections with their peers, being denied the traditional classroom setting.
Now, breaking down some of these numbers, third graders in high poverty schools showed the biggest declines, an 11% point decline in reading, 17% decline in math. But there's even a more worrisome part. These numbers could be worse if they had test scores from all kids. They only have scores from those who took tests, and some test takers disappeared during the pandemic. They don't know where they are.
I think it's really concerning. We need to be reaching out to those kids and re-engaging them in schooling. It's concerning for our making sense of our analyses as well, I think.
Did the kids not show up to virtual learning or in-person when the schools went back? Are they on the streets? Are they on the couch playing video games or worse? Nobody knows, but there are kids who have just kind of disappeared, mainly in high poverty areas. It's a mystery where they are. Schools are going to have to deal with that as classes go back. One more note, NWEA saying it will take unprecedented levels of growth to make up for the past school year as students were learning remotely. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Alex Stone, ABC News.
Even though unemployment numbers still hung around 400,000 this week, second quarter growth showed the economy is back to pre-pandemic size. The recovery, we know, though, has been uneven for many. This weekend, many will lose the moratorium on rent assistance, and many others are gearing up for life back at the office this fall. On the ABC News Daily podcast Start Here, ABC's Brad Milkey spoke with one of the people who will soon possibly be out of a place to live. Tariana Clark says her landlord has let her know that when the rent moratorium runs out, he is prepared to serve her with an eviction notice.
He already told me, like, if I don't have any type of money for him on the first, that he's going to be putting out a 5 to 10 day eviction notice. And I mean, I can't be mad at him because, like, it's all fair. Like, if I was the one that ran these apartments, I'd be looking for my money too. You know what I'm saying? Like, I understand where you're coming from, but, like, I just need leniency just for, like, give me, like, 3 to 4 weeks or just this month just so I can, like, give you something like unemployment. Like, I was getting $240 or $250. I have bills that stack to the roof. Like, lights are expensive. Like, I literally had a $638 light bill that, you know, I couldn't even, like, pay them.
When COVID hit, another group of people really suffered. And this one you probably don't see and hear about every day. Sex workers. They found themselves without much support at all during the pandemic. Our partners at the data and news site 538 interviewed one of the highest paid legal sex workers in the country, as well as advocates documenting how sex work in America has changed from both a legal and a cultural perspective.
There is really no social distancing options within the legal brothel that were really set up and ready to go.
Alice Little is a sex worker at one of Nevada's legal brothels. She's been incredibly successful, booking about $1 million a year just before the pandemic. On March 19, 2020, Nevada's governor ordered the state's brothels to close due to concerns over COVID-19. About a month later, Alice decided she needed a new long-term plan, so she jumped all in on online work and joined OnlyFans, an adults-only social media platform. For many sex workers, the pandemic has fundamentally changed how they do business. While not all sex workers have had the resources or the desire to move their businesses online, some people who've built their careers doing in-person work have made the shift. And research suggests that while the in-person sex market has yet to recover from the pandemic, participation in online sex work is booming. However, that doesn't mean it's easy money. For decades, longtime performers have gotten kicked off websites and payment processors, and that's only becoming more common as the industry moves online.
Sex work is really vast and all-encompassing.
An adult performer for nearly 3 decades, Cinnamon Love has acted in films and worked as a dominatrix, among other jobs. She explained that during the pandemic, some in-person sex workers faced the same issues as many independent contractors because they couldn't access unemployment benefits.
If you are doing in-person sex work, it's really hard to even get government entitlements because if you don't have an address, you can't apply for food stamps or Medicaid. If you don't have a pay stub or a 1099 or tax returns, it's hard to get housing.
Businesses like strip clubs were not entitled to disaster loan assistance for small businesses because of so-called prurient clauses. That left many legal sex workers out of the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP.
There's no safety net. This leads to a lot of depression and a lot of people just giving up.
As the director of communication for the Sex Workers Project at the Urban Justice Center in New York City, Zola Bruce educates people about sex work and said that while online sex work may have been an attractive option during the pandemic, online sex workers still face financial traps.
We can't even really set up bank accounts unless we have another legalized job. So if you don't have a bank account, then your money is all either in Venmo or Cash App.
The pandemic has accelerated a shift to online work that has been building for years. But many are excited to get back to in-person work.
If there is any industry that will continue to exist for the foreseeable future, it's going to be full-service sex work. And it's the world's oldest profession for a reason.
Michael Tabb narrated that report. He joins me now to talk about the findings. Tell us more about some of these sex workers that have found themselves without a whole lot of support.
Yeah, I mean, you think about an industry that's incredibly stigmatized. You had people facing all sorts of different issues because of this. You had people who were working in legal businesses like sex toy shops who were left out of small business loans because of prurient clauses that blocked any money going to businesses of a objectionable moral nature. If you even go to the Small Business Administration website, as though you're starting to apply for these, you see a checkbox and it's right there about the business being of a prurient nature. And you have to select that. I mean, I think one of the really hard things about this is that some sex workers are really struggling at the extreme levels of society. So you have people who are selling sex on the street, and you can still do that during a pandemic. It's just incredibly dangerous. And it's a really, really particularly tough spot to be, especially because when demand gets lower, you may end up being forced into terms that aren't as safe.
Tell me a little bit more about the workers who are helping other workers get by, teaching them how to make a living online, teaching them how to kind of game the system, if you will.
Yeah, so I spoke with Cinnamon Love, an adult film actress who's been in the field for decades and has done all sorts of work, from working as a dominatrix to adult films. And she started this group that is really looking to help educate younger people of color who are interested in sex work so they can make this maybe not a lucrative profession, but can make enough to support themselves, support their families. And it really is about developing a community, especially on a platform like OnlyFans, which doesn't really have a search function for finding sex workers. You really need to be able to market yourself.
Were you encouraged by anything in your piece that you did?
I think even just the label sex worker has a lot of power in that it's able to bring a lot of different people together. There are so many levels of privilege within this, but having people come together as sex workers seems like it's really been important in building the community as a whole and fighting for different things like decriminalization.
Well, Michael Tabb, your piece is great, and you can find it on the 538 website about sex work during the pandemic and all the ways that people have had to change because of it. Really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
The conversation in Tokyo has mostly focused on the coronavirus and whether the Olympic Games should actually be going on at all. Well, they are going on. And then came the shocking moment on the gymnastics floor. USA star Simone Biles pulling out of the women's team final and the women's individual all-around competition, for which she won gold 5 years ago, citing mental health concerns. Simone Biles is considered by many to be the greatest Olympic gymnast of all time, but she was under so much pressure after dominating 2016 performance. This year's games, however, came on the heels of the Larry Nassar sex abuse trial, Biles herself a victim of his crimes, and she's been dealing with, like the rest of us, even more stress amid the pandemic. ABC's Kenneth Moten was there when it happened. He's in Tokyo, talked about it this week with ABC's Diane Macedo in a roundtable that also included USA Today sports columnist Christine Brennan and therapist Dr. Teresa Taylor Williams.
Kenneth, I'll start with you. You were actually in the arena when Simone Biles stumbled on vault and then pulled out of the team finals. How did she and her team seem as this all happened?
Well, they seemed pretty confident that they should move the way they were moving, which is for Simone Biles to pull out, to step away, to allow Team USA Gymnastics to move forward so that they could get as many points as they could, again, winning silver. But I will say, for those inside those stands, even though there are no public spectators, a lot of media there, a lot of people who analyze Simone Biles and what she can do, there was first concern for Simone Biles because we all want to know what was going on. Selfishly, there was disappointment because when it comes to Simone Biles, there is no one, Diane, who can do what she does. She's the greatest of all time. And if you have a chance to see her compete in person, you want that. But you also have to think about her health and safety, which is why we've seen the outpouring of support for Simone Biles. Many praising her actions, saying that she needs a mental health day. She needs that mental health rest. And many pointing out that when it comes to gymnastics, Diane, this is a dangerous sport. If gymnasts doesn't have his or her mind in that right place, they can hurt themselves. They can injure themselves. They can break their necks. They can even kill themselves by what they do there. And so this is something that has to be a priority.
And Christine, I know you're in Tokyo as well. What are you hearing from other athletes about Biles' decision to now withdraw from the individual all around as well?
that has just rocked these Olympic Games. The ripple effects are all over. Everyone's talking about it. When I say everyone, at the swimming venue, all the swimmers, gold medalists, Katie Ledecky and Ariane Titmus from Australia, being asked about it, especially Katie Ledecky talking in a beautiful way about Simone. They're 3 days apart in age, born in March of 1997, their parallel structure in their lives. And of course, two of the biggest names here. And Katie talked about just how hard it is. This is not like a swimmer going out and having a bad day, but they could still maybe swim, or a runner, or even a football player, a baseball player. Simone Biles could get injured very seriously if she's not on top of her game. And I think that is, of course, again, a concern of so many of the Olympic athletes.
So, Dr. Williams, if Simone Biles had hurt her arm or her leg or something like that, it'd be really easy to understand why she wouldn't compete. But a lot of people just don't get why mental health would impede someone from competing like this. So can you explain a little bit about the factors at play here?
The factors at play, number one, of course, is her physical health and that she could have hurt herself very badly. But as far as mental health is concerned, because we can't see the scars, because if we break an arm or a leg, we don't have a cast, people look at us and say, oh, you're fine, because we don't see the physical representation of what you're suffering from. Mental health is the base for all of what we do. And so we cannot perform at our highest level at any of our professions if our mental health is not at its peak and we are well. And so what Simone Biles has done has shown great courage. She has made it so much easier for us in the mental health community to do our jobs for someone at her level, the greatest of all time at this young woman's young age, is just amazing. And what she has done is taken her own mental health, saying, this is what's most important now for me.
And Christine, Simone talked a lot about the immense pressure surrounding these Olympic Games, even saying she felt the weight of the world on her shoulders. What do you think she meant by that? And what do you say to critics who say, well, that pressure just comes with being an elite athlete?
I think Simone's talking about being a survivor as well, the terrible, horrific Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal, the worst sex abuse scandal in the history of sports. And Simone really had to put the sport on her back and be the conscience of the sport, calling out the leaders for all of their failings. So she's been doing that over the last 3 or 4 years, as she has herself been a survivor of this terrible sexual abuse. So I think she means that. And then as far as those who are out there criticizing her, I hope she's not looking at that on social media. Of course, those people will be out there. But this is a great athlete who said, I can't do it. And I think we need to believe her and listen to her, respect her, and learn from her, as I believe we're really looking at a movement here of athletes, Michael Phelps, of course, Naomi Osaka, now Simone Biles, who are talking about issues that are so important, not only to them, but to our children. They're role models to millions, and they can really help people around the world.
So, Dr. Williams, what do you think is the broader impact of this decision on the overall conversation around mental health in sports, but also mental health in general?
You know, the fact that we have athletes and entertainers and people who are so visible, you know, who have fans everywhere. Simone Biles' action on an international stage will bring this conversation to the forefront, that not only are athletes powerful and amazing people and great at what they do, they are also human and they have to attend to their behavioral health. This conversation is going to elevate. It's going to make us take a look at what they do, but also the humanistic side, that they are human, that they feel everything that anyone else feels, and that they cannot be pushed to a breaking point. And I think for so many young women and young men who are looking at these athletes and saying, I want to be just like them and be at the Olympics one day, but maybe I also suffer from anxiety or depression, or I have mental health challenges, I can still do it.
ABC's Diane Macedo speaking with ABC's Kenneth Bowden and USA Today sports columnist Christine Brennan from Tokyo, as well as therapist Dr. Teresa Taylor Williams. Coming up, as police officers testify about exactly what happened on Capitol Hill January 6th, we'll tell you where we stand when it comes to arrests and trials of the rioters on Perspective after this.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, the Summer of Soul, the other legendary concert that took place in 1969. But first, dramatic testimony this week from four police officers who tried to defend the Capitol on January 6th. They were the first witnesses to the House Select Committee investigating the riot that took place on the day that Joe Biden's win as president was solidified by Congress as required in the Constitution. ABC's Rachel Scott was at the hearing.
The hearing, raw and emotional. Sergeant Akilno Ganell, an Army veteran, testified first, saying the insurrection was more terrifying than serving in Iraq. Officer Daniel Hodges, visibly shaken, forced to relive the moment he was pinned in the doorway by men he called terrorists.
At the hearing, we saw new videos. Supporters of President Trump barreling their way into the Capitol as Metropolitan Police Officers Michael Fanone and Daniel Hodges, as well as Capitol Police Officers Aquilino Ganell and Harry Dunn, tried to hold them off. Here's just some of what they had to say.
They ripped off my badge. They grabbed and stripped me of my radio. They seized ammunition that was secured to my body. They began to beat me with their fists and with what felt like hard metal objects.
A man attempted to rip the baton from my hands, and we wrestled for control. I retained my weapon. After I pushed him back, he yelled at me, "You're on the wrong team." One man tried and failed to build a rapport with me, shouting, "Are you my brother?" Another takes a different tack, shouting, "You will die on your knees."
For the first time, I was more afraid to work at the Capitol than my entire deployment to Iraq.
Us four officers, we would do January 6th all over again. We wouldn't stay home because we knew it was going to happen. We would show up. That's courageous.
So where do we stand when it comes to the arrest and trials of those who pushed, shoved, and beat their way into the U.S. Capitol on January 6th? ABC's Aaron Katursky has been following the Department of Justice investigation and joins us now. Where do we stand when it comes to arrests, when it comes to possible convictions, and maybe a trial of some of these people who carried out some of these attacks?
Sherry, there have now been more than 550 people, by our count, charged by federal prosecutors in Washington, D.C. with various roles. Well over 100 have been accused of attacking police officers outright. Others have been charged simply with unlawfully entering the Capitol or being on restricted grounds and disrupting the congressional procedure that was underway to certify the election. And prosecutors said they are not going to stop until they identify everyone that can be identified. And a lot of them have been identified, in fact, by members of the public. Many of them are starting plea negotiations now. Just a handful have actually been fully convicted and sentenced. So this prosecution is going to go on for months and months.
There were a lot of people who have now are looking at charges that are mostly misdemeanors. They were in the Capitol. They found themselves there. And now they found themselves maybe without jobs or facing other personal consequences. Have there been cases of that happening because of what happened on January 6th?
The public has completely turned, it seemed, on the rioters. And of course, in political certain corners, they find support. That's not a surprise. Some of them have tried to downplay their role. Some criminal defense attorneys have tried to suggest that they're being unduly punished. But at other turns, judges have, in fact, sought to really admonish defense attorneys who try to downplay the impact of the January 6th riot at the Capitol on American democracy and won't allow these defense attorneys to get away with it. And so too the public. When some of these people have been identified, they have lost jobs. They've been turned in some cases by their employer, by their own family members in some cases. And many of them, Sherry, let's be honest, were not hard to find. They bragged about their endeavor online and posted pictures about it. There was one guy just charged this week, a former state Senate candidate, a plumber from Brooklyn, who posted pictures and was actively talking to friends on social media about his participation. And at one point, though, he kind of realized, oh, hey, we better take some of these videos down. And you get the sense, too, that for some of the defendants, they really ended up getting caught in the moment and now have, you know, regrets.
And the House Select Committee will be meeting again next month in August, probably at the end of the month. Right, Aaron?
Probably by the end of the month. They've said they wanted to do it before they get out for the summer. And they've also talked openly about a number of members of Congress who themselves could be called to testify, particularly Republican allies of former President Trump, who seemed to at times maybe be on the phone with the White House or to have had a role in maybe creating the conditions that laid the groundwork for the insurrection. Even some Republican members of Congress, like Liz Cheney, have said that they would issue subpoenas for some members if they don't cooperate.
ABC's Aaron Katursky, thank you much.
Thanks, Sherry.
One Nation Under Fire. This week, ABC News took a close look at gun violence that's been ripping across the nation. ABC Chief Law and Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas went for a ride along with police in Philadelphia to examine what's been happening in cities nationwide.
More than 1,000 incidents, more than 430 dead, 1,000 wounded in 1 week. As we started our investigation, gunshots outside of Nationals Park. That same night, a mother and her baby caught in the crossfire at a corner store in West Philadelphia, wounding the one-year-old.
I'm tired of this. I'm sick and tired of this.
Day after day, we saw so many children affected by this violence. One boy shot in a bedroom.
And the bullet just went through the wall, went through his head.
Tristan Jaden Rosas in San Antonio, Texas, was only 15 and playing video games, hit by a stray bullet.
When you promise a kid that you're gonna protect them, that's a promise you can never take back.
Altogether, an unspeakable toll. More than 39 dead, 94 wounded under age 18, and of the deceased, 6 children under 12. We also saw mass shootings play out across the country, 18 incidents in 12 communities. And sadly, we followed as reports of suspected domestic violence ticked up. At least 44 cases, among them a mother and child allegedly kidnapped.
A female and her child was abducted. At Cheney Lake, there was an altercation that occurred.
Virtually no area of the country was immune. But as ABC dug into the numbers, they showed violence disproportionately hit poor and urban areas. From Los Angeles to Chicago to New York.
Are people more brazen in carrying their weapons? Has something shifted?
I don't think there's any doubt. But the data here in New York City is more guns on the scene of shootings, more rounds being fired.
New York City saw a 73% increase in shootings in May 2021 compared to the same time last year.
So this is again,
Commissioner Dermot Shea told us a lethal mix of factors is largely driving the surge. Gang violence, budget cuts, COVID shutting down the courts, leaving a backlog of more than 5,000 gun cases.
Taking the gun off the street is great, but really what we need is we need the individual carrying the gun off the street.
Increasing gun arrests and targeting repeat offenders has led to some signs of success. A dip in the rate last month. Shea remains unsatisfied.
When you look at who's getting shot in this city right now, it's about 97% people of color.
For Chief Judith Harrison, the fight is personal.
As an African-American, obviously it was painful to hear that. He said 90% of your victims are people of color.
Yes.
horrifying statistic. It's not just about people of color. It's about everyone.
Philadelphia facing an even worse explosion.
It's been a minute since I've done this.
Philly police allowing us to ride along. Small number of streets infected with gun violence.
The streets that night quiet until they weren't.
And now there's reports of shots fired at another end of the city.
A shooting outside this restaurant, famous for its cheesesteaks.
I don't know what it is. You get closer to 2 o'clock, stuff starts popping.
As we waited at the scene, the horrible news.
So he was pronounced deceased.
The person here
died. Correct.
That's horrible.
Philadelphia Police Commissioner Danielle Outlaw telling us the argument was over a parking space. In so many neighborhoods, small numbers of repeat offenders terrorizing overwhelmingly law-abiding citizens.
I said, I'm shot. And then I felt the heat and my legs were all running away.
This Philly resident shot in the leg along with another man standing in front of her home.
I shouldn't have to be afraid to stay in my home.
At the end of a sobering week, we're left with the vigils.
Cree is looking down on us right now.
The lives lost, the families grieving, and the almost certain knowledge that next week is all but guaranteed to happen again.
ABC's Pierre Thomas there with one of the many reports this week that are part of the ABC News special on gun violence. You can listen to the entire series on demand. Open whatever app you use for podcasts and search for a podcast called ABC News Radio Specials. The year was 1969. Yes, we went to the moon that year, and yes, there was a little gathering north of New York City called Woodstock. But that summer, another festival also took place, one you might not have heard of. It was called the Harlem Cultural Festival, and it featured some of the biggest names in music. ABC's Byron Pitts has more on that historic musical event.
The Harlem Cultural Festival was this beautiful event, Sly and the Family Stone, B.B. King, Nina Simone.
Are you ready, black people? Are you ready?
All types of artists, pop acts of the day, gospel acts like Mahalia Jackson. All these key figures in black music came together.
The breathtaking performance is so beautifully documented in vivid color. Now featured in the new Hulu documentary, Summer of Soul, directed by Amir Thompson, otherwise known as Questlove.
This film is unpacking a lot of emotion for people that I didn't realize.
The festival came at a heartbreaking and historic time in black America, 1 year after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
So the impetus of the whole festival was the fact that when Martin Luther King was assassinated, all of America, inner city America, went up in flames with rioting. And not wanting a repeat performance of what happened, that made it easier for the city to okay the idea of having some sort of event that would keep people occupied during the weekend.
The six-week festival showcased an astonishing group of performers, the likes of David Ruffin and the Temptations.
I've got sunshine.
A baby-faced 19-year-old Stevie Wonder, the Chambers Brothers. And pop soul group, The Fifth Dimension. The crowd who come to see those acts, 300,000 strong. But the footage of the festival lost to history, buried in the archives for 50 years. Until now, brought back to life by Questlove.
I'm realizing that, you know, I'm looking at over 40 hours of footage of really some amazing performances, and I'm just trying to rack my brain out to think, who would deny this? Like, who would deny this performances and these powerful stories? You know, it's 50 years later, and I still feel as though the material is potent and strong enough to still inspire people and touch them.
That same summer, 100 miles away, another historic festival was taking place, one that was said to have defined an age of music in history, Woodstock. While Woodstock was hailed as a pivotal moment in popular culture, the Harlem Cultural Festival was practically forgotten.
The true lesson that I've learned from all this is that the term black erasure is real and not an exaggeration. This particular event wasn't allowed the same process, and it just sat in someone's basement for 50 years. My purpose was to correct history.
ABC Radio's own Candace Williams spoke with Questlove about his directorial debut. He reflected on the importance of the festival and how it relates to the current moment.
This being your directorial debut, what made this the perfect project to get behind? And were you specifically looking for a feature or a project that incorporated music?
This film found me. I was approached, you know, thinking that I was this like wise music savant and a college professor. And these guys are telling me that, yeah, you know, back in 69, 300,000 people saw Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight and the Pips, and Sly and the Family Stone, and Nina Simone, and Mahalia Jackson, and Ray Barretto. And I was embarrassed. I'm like, how do I not know about this? To be told that this footage sat in a basement for 50 years, that let me know how dangerous the idea of black erasure is, be it something as historical as this particular concert, even something as minuscule in our eyes as like social media content creators like TikTok not getting proper credit. This wasn't about my directorial debut more than it was about my chance to correct history. It was important to show the context of what they lived through, to show that it's mirroring exactly what we're going through right now. Even the irony wasn't lost on me that we're repeating history. I hope that this film is a slow turnaround and a paradigm shift to let artists know that they have a responsibility to use their voice and their activism. We're seeing artists sort of get back to that place, but for a while there, I kind of lost hope that we could find our activist voice that we used to have.
ABC's Candace Williams speaking with musician Questlove, making his directorial debut, Summer of Soul, which you can view anytime on Hulu. Finally this week, he was the inventor of the Chop-O-Matic, the smokeless ashtray, the bedazzler, hairspray in a can, and so many more.
Introducing Auto Cup by Ronco, the amazing no-spill cup.
There's never been anything like it. Popeil's Pocket Fisherman.
This Christmas,
Ron
get them
Popeil
the new
got his start selling kitchen gadgets on Chicago's iconic Maxwell Street. Eventually, his Ronco inventions were all over TV. If you were a kid growing up in the 70s or 80s, you couldn't miss them. In fact, one of our favorites might even have gotten a few of us to take up a certain profession.
These kids are having a fabulous time with Mr. Microphone, the cordless microphone that actually puts your voice on the radio, broadcast over any FM car radio.
Hey, good looking. We'll be back to pick you up later.
According to his obituary, Ron Popeil had the uncanny ability to identify a need the consumer didn't realize, only to then engineer a product that delivered its promise flawlessly to millions of customers. All of his inventions have been archived by the Smithsonian Institution.
And it's only $14.88. Mr. Microphone, buy two or three. They really make great Christmas gifts.
Ron Popeil was 86. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.